I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Let's get right to the latest economic news. Business owners whose credit lines are drying up in the global credit freeze, who rely on short-term daily, weekly, sometimes monthly loans to make payroll or buy supplies, may have a new partner. The Federal Reserve today announced it will tap into a Depression-era power to buy these short-term debts from businesses. Now, generally, the Fed, created by Congress, does business with banks. Well, now it will loan money to businesses in an attempt to free up credit. Greg Ipp of The Economist joins us. And, Greg, it seems everyone woke up yesterday to realize the $700 billion Treasury Department bailout of Wall Street will take something like 45 days to kick in. So here comes the Fed with some quicker help for businesses. How unusual is this?
Well, it is very unusual, Robin. But in the context of the times, it's getting less unusual with every passing week. The Fed has already taken quite a few radical steps in the last year in an effort to unblock the credit markets, and this is just the latest. Traditionally, the Fed only lends to banks, but in March, they began lending to securities dealers as well, such as Morgan Stanley and Goldman Sachs. And this is yet another extension of their power to actually lend directly to companies. Now, they're setting up what they call a special purpose vehicle, which is basically like a legal device which they will actually lend the money to, and then this entity will go out and buy the commercial paper that is issued by industrial companies, any company like an airline or a publishing company. And this is paper that companies routinely issue. These are simply IOUs that they issue to, for example, money market mutual funds for 90 days, for example. And it's been very difficult for them to issue that money lately because money market mutual funds have become very risk-averse and all they want to own is Treasury bills.
Right, because nobody trusts anybody else, and so the credit has frozen, as we've been saying here in the program. But when it comes to businesses, we've talked quite a bit as well about how, you know, many healthy businesses rely on sort of revolving loans to make payroll, to do day-to-day expenses. Is this the kind of thing that the Fed will now be buying from businesses?
Yes. Well, what they're trying to position themselves is as a backstop. And what that essentially means is that if the companies are unable to find anybody to lend them the money, they can then go to this, Fed-endorsed vehicle to get the money. And the Fed kind of hopes that just the existence of this vehicle or this entity will restore confidence and enable companies to get their money. Because the theory is that the reason the money market mutual funds aren't buying this short-term debt, it's not because they think the companies are about to fail or that they're unhealthy. It's that they're worried that when the 90 days expires and it's time for the companies to repay the money back, the companies won't be able to find someone else to roll the debt over. So you have this kind of like mutual suspicion, which is bringing the gears of commerce to a halt. And the Fed hopes that by being there, that they'll restore confidence.
But Greg, who qualifies? How's it supposed to work?
Essentially, any company that issues the top-rated type of commercial paper will be eligible. But I understand that they'll first have to sort of show that they weren't able to, for example, issue it in the normal course of business.
How much money does the Federal Reserve have? Yesterday, we talked about the Fed expanding its emergency lending program to banks by hundreds of millions. We know they can print money, but if the Federal Reserve gets into the business of printing a lot of money for all of this debt it's going to take on, don't we just get into hyperinflation?
Well, it's a little bit more complicated than that, and the reason why is that, yes, the Fed does not have limits on how much money it can essentially create. It would be inflationary if they were creating brand new debt, and that was being put into people's hands, and they were going out to spend it on goods and services. But really, all they're doing is they're replacing the lending that is dried up in the private sector. So it's not so much that they're creating new loans. It's just that the old loans that were made by the private sector have been replaced by new loans that have been made by the central bank. And even at that, it's not clear at all that this will be sufficient to sort of offset the increased nervousness and recalcitrance on the part of companies to invest or hire. The bigger risk for the Fed is that these are the types of decisions, you know, who shall we lend money to, that are not really the purview of an independent central bank. It's really the kind of job that Congress is supposed to do or the administration. And that is one reason why the Fed is doing this with the endorsement of the Treasury Department. And indeed, the Treasury will provide the funding to actually get this vehicle up and running.
Greg, is there a sense from your frontline point of view that this is helping, that it's calming nerves at all, that it's going to thaw some of the credit freeze?
Well, there was some short-term positive response in the stock market today, but it will take some time to tell. I mean, this, as I mentioned earlier, is one of many, many steps both the Fed and the Treasury and the Congress have undertaken to try and contain this crisis. And it's dangerous after being disappointed so often before to say that this is the one that'll turn things around. I think it's more important just to observe that we clearly have a Fed that is willing to essentially be very creative and test the limits in order to stop this crisis from spreading.
Greg Ipp of The Economist magazine, thank you so much.
It was a pleasure.
And we're told the fallout from the credit crisis isn't really being felt yet. Well, today we want to take a look at how it might impact health care. The presidential candidates debate tonight in Tennessee, we're going to take a look at that a little later in the program. But at the last debate, they were unwilling to say what they might have to give up in their presidential plans. Well, analysts are saying they might have to give up a lot in health care. Trudy Lieberman is director of the Health and Medical Reporting Program at the Graduate School of Journalism at the City University of New York. She's also contributing editor to the Columbia Journalism Review and recently wrote a series on the candidates in health care, spelling out how John McCain and Barack Obama's proposals will impact different people, insured, uninsured, underinsured, in a poor town in Arkansas. Trudy joins us now. First off, how do you think this fiscal crisis will impact the candidates' plans?
I think that it will probably end up putting health care on the back burner because both plans call for considerable amounts of money to help people who are currently uninsured, and I'm afraid that it could be set back for a while.
John McCain wrote before the current crisis that he wants the health care system to mirror the country's banking system, where there would be, quote, more choices of innovative products, less burdened by the worst excesses of state-based regulation. His plan is to move people away from employer programs towards private insurance. But we can see what's happening to the banking system.
Well, what we've seen in the banking crisis is that financial institutions did come out with a whole bunch of new, dangerous, innovative instruments. And many of these new financial products that really began in the 1980s and flourished in the 90s and really up until the last year or so were pretty dangerous for people, and worse, they were pretty much unregulated. I think that we could duplicate that in the insurance area. We don't have a lot of regulation now. Insurance regulation is pretty much left up to the states, and there is a wide variation among the states in how much and how forceful that regulation is. But we've also seen companies coming out with new innovative products, and they are touting them just that way. And to me, it's very reminiscent of this whole financial crisis.
Well, let's take a look at what you found. Can you just remind us what each of the candidates' plans were?
Obama's plan builds on the present public-private system that we have, the public part being Medicare, Medicaid, and the Children's Health Insurance Program. The private part is the commercial insurance that most of the rest of us have that we get from companies like Cigna and Blue Cross and Aetna. And what Obama would do is let people stay in the insurance that they want. He would not require anyone to get insurance except the parents would have to get it for their kids. He would expand the public programs, Medicaid and SCHIP, then create something called a public program, which would compete with the private insurance carriers. And we're not quite sure what this public program would be, whether it would be a government program like Medicare, where Medicare provides the benefits, or whether it would just be a selection of policies that people could buy on the private market. Now, McCain, on the other hand, takes American health insurance in a very different direction. He would do away, ultimately, with the employer-based system. Much of the insurance in this country is provided by employers through the workplace, and that coverage is getting more and more problematic for a lot of people as employers are unable to pay the increasing costs. McCain would like to eventually do away with that system and have everyone buy their insurance in the private market. And he would do that by encouraging people to go into that market and leave their employer plan by giving them a tax credit of $2,500 for individuals and $5,000 for families. There are a few problems with such a credit. The value of the credit doesn't seem to increase as the cost of insurance goes up, so that if you buy a policy with a $2,500 credit that might be okay this year, it may not go very far 5 years from now when the policy will cost maybe four or five times what it costs today.
So John McCain hopes to lure people into the competitive private market with these tax credits to buy insurance. But he's also hoping to push them out of employer plans with taxes.
He would tax the value of the health insurance benefits that people receive from their employer. This is a way to raise money for the government, and I wouldn't be surprised to see people on both sides of the aisle advance the solution in the new Congress, and whether that money will be used to pay for subsidies for the uninsured or tax credits, it remains to be seen.
Well, you went to the little town of Helena, Arkansas, along the Mississippi River. The median family income there, just $21,000, about that, compared to maybe $50,000 for the rest of the U.S., so a poor town. You were struck by how much money they're paying out of pocket and how little they know even about the debate over medical care.
That's correct. I found substantial amounts of what the policy researchers like to call underinsurance. You have insurance, so that's a good thing, but the insurance really doesn't cover all of your medical expenses. It's generally defined as paying more than 10% of your income on out-of-pocket costs, including copayments, deductibles. And one man, Kevin Smith, who runs an insurance agency in the town, has four kids and no substantial health problems, just run-of-the-mill things. And he was paying $7,000 and $8,000 a year.
In fact, he's fascinating because he sells insurance, but what did he say to you?
He thinks that we ought to move to a single-payer system. And when I asked him why he was saying that, because that runs counter to what we hear the business community saying, he says he would do much better under a single-payer system. And when I asked, well, aren't you going to lose money, he said, no, not at all. He said, I think people would be better able to pay for their auto insurance and their home insurance and their life insurance, and maybe even buy long-term care insurance. They didn't have to worry about the health insurance.
In fact, he was finding clients who were, first of all, not buying other kinds of insurance or late on their payments for other kinds of insurance because they were so struggling to pay their health care.
That's right. It was sort of a nightmare for his family who was running this business to try to collect all these premiums.
And we just want to be clear with Kevin Smith and his family. They had no chronic illness. They just had the everyday life. A son got a concussion playing football. A wife broke a rib. They do seem to be slightly accident prone. But you know, the average family that's active also will fall off a bike occasionally. These are some of the accidents they had, and suddenly they're in debt.
They were bikers to exercise, which is what we tell people to do.
How would Kevin Smith fare under a Barack Obama plan?
I don't think he would be touched at all by Obama's plan. He has insurance. You can stay with what you have, and Kevin Smith has good insurance provided by an employer. And I think that he would probably stay in that, underinsured, as long as his kids keep falling off of bikes and having concussions, and the price of medical care keeps going up.
And by the way, under the McCain plan, the Smith family could get that $5,000 credit to buy private insurance, but Kevin has just developed asthma, which would count as a pre-existing condition, so he told you he's going to stay with employer insurance. Well, later today, will health care and the economy trump people the candidates used to know at tonight's debate? That's later. Back in a minute with more from Trudy Here and Now. We're back with more on how the presidential candidates' health care plans might impact a small town in Arkansas. Trudy Lieberman is director of the Health and Medical Reporting Program at the City University of New York and contributing editor to the Columbia Journalism Review. She recently wrote a series after visiting a small town in Arkansas along the Mississippi. And Trudy, tell us about the Bells. You met James Bell III and his 43-year-old son, James Bell IV. The father works two jobs, has insurance, but it's a 70-30 plan, meaning the plan covers 70%, he pays 30% out of pocket. The son has diabetes, has trouble walking, breathing, has no insurance, he's disabled, no job, no money to buy life-saving insulin or test strips. He sometimes gets some for free for drug companies. Now, this struck us because I think many people assume that if you're severely ill, a diabetic, you have to have insulin to survive, test strips to find out what your sugar level is. You automatically qualify for Medicaid, the government program for the indigent, the poor, or the disabled. But he didn't?
No. Single adult men often do not qualify for Medicaid in most states, and certainly Arkansas is one of them. he theoretically could spend down under the Medicaid Medically Needy program, which means that he would have to accumulate so many dollars in medical expenses before he would be eligible for Arkansas's Medically Needy program. But that's really a catch-22 because he didn't really have the money to go spend it on health care in the first place. And the doctors down in that town were not exactly giving their services away for free. So he was really caught in a bind. He was not able to accumulate the bills that he needed to qualify. And so he was pretty much out of luck. His other choice would be to try to apply for Social Security disability. And many people do that. And here they encounter another catch-22. If they should pass through all the hoops to qualify for SSDI, which is the short form for Social Security disability, then they have a 2-year waiting period before they qualify for Medicare. And during this 2-year period, it's very, very difficult for many of them.
The senior Bell, Mr. Bell, can't help his son, can't even insure his own wife because he is spending money every month for his own blood pressure medication. And as we said, he has a 70-30 plan, so he has to pay for 30% of his own care. So tell us, how would both Bells fare under the proposed plans from the two candidates, McCain and Obama?
The younger Bell might do better under Obama. He would not be helped very much by McCain. He's pretty much uninsurable. And so any kind of plan to send people like him into the private market to buy insurance without requiring insurance companies to take people like that is not going to help him very much. Obama has said that he would regulate insurance companies and make them take people with pre-existing conditions, which is fine if that can emerge from the legislative sausage grinder. And my guess is that the insurance companies will fight very hard to keep the ability to turn away people who are going to be bad risks. If Obama does succeed in getting a public program off the ground, then theoretically the younger Bell might be able to buy insurance in the public program with, and I say this as a great big caveat, with probably 100% subsidy. And here you get into the problem of how much Congress is going to make available and what the price tag is going to be. Now, the elder Bell is going to run into a problem under McCain right off the bat. He's going to have to pay taxes now on the value of the health insurance benefits he gets from the town. He doesn't have very much income, so he's going to find himself paying taxes on a portion of these insurance benefits.
And we should say he works for the town, right? He has two jobs.
Yes, he's the head jailer for the town.
Mm-hmm.
And his other job is at McDonald's as a grill cook, and his insurance is from the town. So he's going to find this additional tax that he has to pay, and he may not have money to pay it.
And that tax was to raise revenue, but also to sort of push people out of their employer plans and into the marketplace. And it doesn't sound as if he would be welcome in the open marketplace either.
He has health problems.
Right.
He's going to have the same problems that his son is going to have. Bell the elder is much better staying where he is, even though he has this 30% coinsurance he has to pay.
By the way, a new report by the Commonwealth Fund shows that McCain's plan in 10 years would reduce the number of uninsured Americans, speaking of the younger Bell, by only 2 million. Obama's would reduce the number by far more, 34 million, but a recent analysis in the journal Health Affairs said Obama's won't rein in the soaring costs, and considering what's going on right now in the current fiscal crisis, that's probably going to be a concern.
We need to consider the cost control measures on both plans. They're very similar. They're almost identical, actually.
Yeah, we should say that both candidates want to improve disease prevention. Obama would also invest in medical record technology, and McCain would block frivolous lawsuits.
The evidence is really not there that disease management and that health information technology is going to save substantial amounts of money. At the margin, it might make the quality of care better for some people. But I think it's wrong to assume that it's going to save gobs of money and make insurance cheaper.
We're back to where we started, Trudy Lieberman. Do you think that John McCain is going to be able to give the tax credits that he talks about, $2,500 to an individual, $5,000 to a family, that Barack Obama is going to be able to expand other coverage for people who are uninsured, given the current fiscal issues?
I think it's going to be very hard for them to deliver on what they are talking about. They're talking about a lot of money, billions of dollars in tax credits and in tax subsidies. And I think that right now that just doesn't look like the money is going to be there.
Trudy Lieberman, Director of the Health and Medical Reporting Program at the Graduate School of Journalism at the City University of New York, also a contributing editor to the Columbia Journalism Review. We'll have all of her series at our website, here-now.org. Trudy Lieberman, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, tomorrow on Here and Now, we'll ask, did health care come up at tonight's presidential debates in Tennessee? Or maybe did former weatherman William Ayers or indicted banker Charles Keating? We'll have a review of the debates. That's tomorrow. Still ahead of today, the view of the economy from a homeless shelter. After the news, Here and Now. John McCain's running mate, Sarah Palin, was on the campaign trail again today, again attacking Barack Obama. She toned down the attacks on former 60s radical-turned-Chicago professor William Ayers and his relationship with Barack Obama, but ratcheted up mention of Barack Obama's former pastor, Jeremiah Wright. McCain launched a new line of attack ad on the stump today, rather attack, on the stump yesterday, asking the question, who is Barack Obama really? McCain's answer in a new ad out today is, Barack Obama is a hypocrite for twisting McCain's record after promising a new style of politics. Well, for his part, the Obama camp responded to the new tone with a 13-minute video highlighting John McCain's friendship with convicted banker Charles Keating of the 1980s savings and loan scandal, and Obama fired a new ad today saying McCain has nothing to say on the economy, so he's resorting to smears that have proven false. As Rick Klein writes, it's on and it's ugly. Rick joins us from Nashville. He's senior political reporter for ABC News and author of ABC's The Note political blog. Rick, it has gotten quite ugly.
It has, and it's not just the weather in Nashville, it's dreadful weather with the rain coming down here, but there's a big turn just since the weekend in the tone of this campaign. And not surprising in a lot of ways because we're into the final month right now, but Barack Obama has opened up a lead, and I think that has forced John McCain to take on a new line of attack and trying to raise this question, as you mentioned, who is Barack Obama? Do we know enough about him? Bringing up all kinds of connections from his background, things from his record, questions that he hasn't answered yet. All of this, I think, just designed to try to play to voters' fears and worries about Barack Obama.
Well, just briefly tell us, what has Barack Obama said about his relationship with William Ayers, the former weatherman?
Well, he has said that when William Ayers was doing the terrible things that he has admitted to doing, Barack Obama was an elementary school student, and he had only tangential relationships with him through the years, served on a board with him in Chicago, obviously knew him through Chicago circles. His campaign saying that when Barack Obama first started the association with Bill Ayers, he wasn't aware of his very colorful history, but this was ancient history, 40 years ago. So to link in any way Bill Ayers' actions with Barack Obama is just silly to their telling. But the McCain campaign comes back and says, look, you can tell a lot about someone from the kind of people that they associate with. And this is a man who still to this day says he wishes he had done more in terms of so-called domestic terrorist operations in the 1960s.
This was William Ayers saying that. Well, what has John McCain said about his relationship with Charles Keating? We know he said it's one of the biggest mistakes of his life. So is it perhaps a mistake to throw out past relationships?
That's certainly the way that the Obama campaign fired back by putting out the web video that you referenced, bringing up Keating 5 for the first time in this campaign. The McCain campaign, although I think obfuscating things a little bit, saying that he was not found to have done anything wrong, although in the past John McCain has recognized this as a big shortcoming. It's something that inspired him to take a new direction in terms of his reform credentials that happened since then. So a little bit of tit-for-tat with personal connections and associations, some guilt by association going on out there, all of it, again, designed to just try to play to voters' fears and worries about the candidates. The Obama campaign says generally that this is just John McCain struggling for any kind of a new message, saying that they haven't found a way to talk about the economy, and they're worried that if this election turns on the economy, they'll lose.
And Rick, briefly, you know, with that in mind and all the economic news, is this going to come up tonight? I mean, will these candidates really make these negative attacks face-to-face?
You know, that's a big question. The McCain campaign has hinted very strongly that these kind of questions about Barack Obama will be brought up. But you have to be careful how you do it. The questions will be not posed by the moderator, but be posed by actual voters, people in the hall, people via the Internet, who suggest questions that Tom Brokaw then suggests or then poses to the candidates directly. So it's not as if you can just, you know, turn this all against the mainstream media, as maybe Sarah Palin did last week, or decide to answer whatever question you want. You'll be held to account by the actual voters. You have to be careful about how you handle it. So I wouldn't expect it to be a night of just out-and-out slashing attacks, but I would be shocked if John McCain doesn't continue some of the storylines that he has tried to play out outside of the debate hall, given the fact that we're under 28 days now.
Well, and also people are going to be able to ask questions from the audience with moderator Tom Brokaw, so it may come through that channel as well. Rick Klein, senior political reporter for ABC News, author of ABC's The Note political blog, speaking to us from Nashville, Tennessee, where, as we said, the second presidential town hall-type debate will be held tonight. Rick, thanks.
Thank you.
Well, we want to turn now to Chaz Sisk, who covers economic issues for the Tennessean newspaper in Nashville. Chaz, Rick says the personal fight is on and it's ugly. We know negative ads are big in battleground states, but how are people viewing all of this in Tennessee?
No, not really. Most of the voters that we're talking to are focused primarily on economic issues. This not being a battleground state, we're not seeing a lot of advertising here on the ground.
So you're not seeing a lot of negative ads. And it seems as if the economy, especially in the last 2 weeks, would be overwhelming everything. What are people saying?
Here, I think we never really had the housing boom that you saw on the coast. And consequently, the home prices really didn't start falling until the last couple of months or so. So I think what's happening here is, as the economy is getting worse across the nation, unemployment's going up here, consumer confidence is going down, and home prices are actually starting to fall here too. And so there's a perception, I think, that this is actually coming to us now here in Middle Tennessee.
Well, I'd say so. I'm reading you write that the state's unemployment rate has risen to 6.6% from 4.7% just a year ago. And in September 2007, 63% of Middle Tennessee consumers said business in the region was good. Now it's just 29% who say that.
Right.
You write that even in your state with a large population of evangelical Christians, who in the past might have focused on abortion and gay marriage, the topic now is the economy. We know there are going to be 150 uncommitted voters who live in the Nashville area who are going to speak tonight. Do you expect the conversation all to be about the economy, or what else do you think they might ask about?
Well, I think the large evangelical population is important, so I think there's a good chance that there will be some questions on social issues like abortion and gay rights, because for some of them that is still important. Though I do think it's clear that those issues are taking a back seat to the economy. Other things that are likely to be brought up, national defense, and also actually I think one issue that's of particular interest here would be energy and particularly gasoline and that policy. We just had a period here after the hurricanes in which there were gas lines and no gasoline at mm-hmm. most gas stations. At one point, 85% of the stations here in our region were out of gasoline. So that's something that is going to be weighing heavily on people's minds.
And you write that concerns are cutting across class lines. You spoke of the Terry Lee Ballard. He was a former loan officer. What's his situation now?
Well, he actually lost his home. The loan officer thing, he lost that job, and then he worked a series of odd jobs. Those have not really panned out well for him, and so now he was renting a home in Madison, which is a working class suburb here, and he's lost that, and so now he's moved to a campground in Lebanon, Tennessee. His plan is to live in a tent through the winter.
Chaz Sisk, who covers economic issues for the Tennessean newspaper in Nashville. Chaz, thanks for speaking with us ahead of tonight's presidential debate.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
I have some more thoughts on homelessness, but first a note. We'd love to hear your thoughts on the debate. Maybe there's something you don't hear tonight. Give a listen to the debate, then email us at here-now.org. That's letters at here-now.org. Or give a call, leave a message, 617-358-0397, 617-358-0397. You're listening to Here and Now. Well, it's probably safe to assume that one fallout from the foreclosure crisis will be more of the homeless. Here in Massachusetts, agencies have been surprised at how many more, a record high. 2,000 families in Massachusetts are in shelters. That's an increase of more than 100 families over last year. Nearly 3,000 individuals are in shelters, also an increase of 100, according to the State Department of Transitional Assistance. And since shelters can't keep up, more than 500 families are being put up in hotels and motels, up from just 27 people last year at this time. Well, John Yazwinski is executive director of Father Bills and Mainspring, a nonprofit that provides shelter for the homeless in Massachusetts. And John, we know you have two shelters, one in Quincy, one in Brockton. What are you seeing this year?
We are very concerned. What we're seeing on the individual side is about a 30% increase of people coming to our door this September compared to last September. And so this September, we're already seeing what we would normally see in the winter months in January of 08.
And this isn't in reaction to this week's financial news, I'm guessing. It's probably financial news that's been building for a year.
Yeah, you know, we've seen it where this was the first summer probably in 5 years that we were full all summer. Mm-hmm. And what we're seeing is a new group of people coming to our door, people that are coming straight from the rental market that are being affected by the foreclosed properties where they've been renting properties that have been foreclosed. And we're seeing a lot of young moms with their kids, the moms that are working low-paying mm-hmm. jobs and having trouble keeping up with all the different increase of costs.
That's an interesting thing to note, because these are, in many cases, working families, and they run into an eligibility problem when it comes to shelters. Tell us about that.
Yeah, what we're seeing is that in the state of Massachusetts, for a family that is homeless, they need to go first not to the nonprofit that provides the shelter, but to the state to see if they are income eligible. And so what we're seeing is more and more families where single moms do have part-time or full-time employment are homeless at the time with their kids but are not getting a shelter bed. Just the other day, I got a call from Quincy School System in Massachusetts where they were with two teenagers and a middle school kid where their mom and the three kids had spent the night in a tent, and the mom worked full time. So what we're seeing here is that people are actually having to quit their jobs to get into shelter.
Right, they're making too much to get into the shelter, but not enough to find any housing on their own, and they're getting evicted from foreclosed homes that had rental units, and it wasn't their foreclosure. You also, I understand, represented an 82-year-old woman?
Yeah, we just last Friday, we had an 82-year-old woman who works come into our building and with her 17-year-old grandson, who she has custody of, and she was facing an eviction. And, you know, she is on a fixed income and does work part-time. And when she went to the state, she was over income. And so we were in housing court with her begging the judge to give her more and more time for us to work so she would not have to come to an emergency shelter and
right.
quit her job.
Again, someone making too much to get into emergency housing. Well, we understand the state covers about 60% of your funded beds in your shelters, and Massachusetts is one of the states that's asking the federal government for some help because of their fiscal problems. Are you concerned about what's ahead?
We are very concerned, and we've got an increase in young adults, kids that are aging out of foster care, 18 to 24, that are coming into our door in record numbers. More veterans. We had a 20% increase in veterans, and we're very concerned that we're not going to be able to get people indoors because of maybe not having the space and or the money.
This is with winter coming, and we understand people are already sleeping on the floor.
Yes, we have already opened up our cafeterias at Father Bills and Mainspring just for the individual programs. We had put up about 71 extra army cots for men and women that we did not have a bed for over the last week.
Do you talk to other people across the country? Does this reflect stories across the country?
I was talking to some people out in the Midwest who don't really have the government support that we have. And they're saying that there's a lot more of people 50 and over that are sleeping in their cars right now because there's not the emergency shelter system that we have. So we are somewhat lucky, even mm-hmm. though, in this part of the country, we have such high housing costs no matter what.
John Yazwinski, executive director of Father Bills and Mainspring, a nonprofit that operates two homeless shelters on the South Shore and also tries to find affordable housing for people. John, best to you and thank you.
No, thank you.
Okay, we'll be back in a minute with a fantasy respite for kids, much needed here and now. We thought we'd take a bit of a breather to explore the world of the fantastical with someone who spends a lot of time there and whose books help kids stay in touch with imagination. First, there was Dragonology, The Complete Book of Dragons. That was in 2003. Followed by Wizardology, Piratology. The Ology books have sold millions of copies worldwide. They're filled with seals to break and envelopes to open and passports to magical worlds. Dragonology, for instance, looks like a book from the late 1800s and was, air quotes here, written by explorer Dr. Ernest Drake, telling the natural history of dragons with elaborate drawings, samples of dragon wings, dragon dust. Kids loved it. Well, Dugald Stier's latest book, Monsterology, The Complete Book of Monstrous Beasts, has just been released. His Dr. Drake is once again our guide, with details on the Arabian unicorn, the bunyip, the cockatrice, and old standbys like Bigfoot and Nessie the Loch Ness Monster. Dugald Stier, known as Doug, the creator of all the Ology books, joins us in the studio with more. Welcome.
Thank you.
Beautiful, as they all are. They look like old, you know, parts of an encyclopedia. But why monsters?
Well, as Dr. Drake had already done a book on dragons, there was quite a lot of call for books on other topics. And we couldn't do a book entirely on unicorns, so we thought we'd throw in some other animals as well.
Well, and Dr. Drake, who, you know, in the photographs looks so much like you. It's really...
Well, you know, he looks incredibly similar to my great-grandfather for a very good reason that you can probably guess.
Yes. But Dr. Drake takes us through the world of monsterology with the same elaborate production as the other books have. Here's a footprint if we want to track a yeti. Here's a specimen taped to the page. It's actual hair from the mane of a unicorn.
Yes, that's right. I mean, I don't know quite how the publisher managed to find and shave so many unicorns.
Yes.
But,
and in this plastic thingy here, there's a specimen of ashes from the nest of a phoenix. More specimens later, skin from the tail of a sea serpent. I mean, how much fun do you have?
I have an awful lot of fun working with the designer. As you say, these are very highly illustrated books, and it's such great fun commissioning these wonderful artists to do all this, all of these lovely pictures, and also putting in all these little touches, like there's a swatch of yeti hair at the back of the book as well.
Yes, and right in the front of the book, I haven't broken the seals because this is going to be going to a little boy at Christmas. But there's an envelope right on the inside of the front cover, and written on it in like old-fashioned writing, to a few intrepid souls, and it's sealed there. What's behind that seal?
Okay, well, that's a letter from Dr. Drake to the reader of the book explaining how he came to write Monsterology.
And how did he?
Well, he spent all his life conserving and protecting those few dragons that remained in the world and studying them. But it had always been a hobby of his, studying other mythical creatures. So he kind of took some time off to go on a trip around the world to seek them out and find out which ones were real.
Mm-hmm.
And to him, he finds that the Yeti's real, where he finds that perhaps the Minotaur is a myth.
Well, you do try to separate fact from fiction on monsters here in the book, and that brings us to one small criticism that we've read from the Guardian newspaper, actually. They just were a little concerned that elsewhere in the series you have, as we mentioned, Piratology books, Egyptology. Now, in the Egyptology book, it was fascinating and informative. It was true. Monsterology, again, you do separate some fact from fiction, but it's the fiction part that, you know, do you worry that kids will, you know, they'll read your Egyptology book and, oh, yes, everything about Egypt, but then get to this and think, well, yeah, of course there's a hippogriff or, well, look, hatching hippogriffs, and not be able to separate fact from fiction?
Well, I don't think that children read these books in isolation, and I think they go and ask mom or dad or their teachers. Because Piratology had a fictional element, the story of Captain William Lubber sailing out of Boston on the trail of Arabella Drummond, the terrible pirate captain.
Mm-hmm.
That story is completely fictitious, whereas all the details of pirates and how pirates lived are absolutely true and historical. So I think that children are usually capable of telling the difference between fact and fiction, and with books like Piratology, I'm hoping that that's a springboard for them to go and find out more about pirates.
Who are historically accurate.
That's right. If they go off looking for details on mythical creatures, they might find that there's a Bigfoot Research Institute, which is trying to find out if Bigfoot really exists, whereas it's pretty certain that, you know, sad be it to say, chimeras are completely mythical and there are no such creatures.
Which were they supposed to be again?
They're the three-headed ones with the goat head, the serpent head, and the lion head.
It reminds us, in reading these books, that there was sort of an adult version years ago. Were you aware of the Griffin and Sabine books?
Yes, that's right.
Purported to be postcards written back and forth between a postcard maker and an island woman.
Mm-hmm.
And that, what is it about that idea of just the tactile of the book?
It makes it more authentic feeling, as though it's someone's old scrapbook or something, that they've actually got these things. Because if kids, say, they go studying creatures by the sea, for example, they pick up bits of shell, they pick up things. It just adds to it, having all these extra bits and pieces.
For instance, as we said, you can feel the skin from the tail of a sea serpent.
Yeah.
Age unknown.
Mm-hmm.
Do you feel ripped off at all? Because a lot of people have, you know, started doing this kind of thing.
When we did Dragonology, which was the first of these, we did hope that we were creating a new kind of genre of book. And so we can't really complain if we've achieved our aim and other people are doing similar things.
Right. Well, Doug Steer, we have a couple last questions for you.
Okay.
Is there such a thing as cockatrice breath, the foul breath of the cockatrice, which may be bottled, preferably with the assistance of a trained weasel, and then thrown at ravenous monsters?
Well, no doubt if you were to find a cockatrice and get a trained weasel, you could bottle the breath and quite possibly use it, according to Dr. Drake.
But, yes.
I myself have never come across such a thing.
And the beast bop?
This is quite interesting. As you'll notice, the beast bop must be performed in an area where there are likely to be carnivorous beasts.
Ah.
And it's to attract carnivorous beasts to you. And it involves stomping, shouting, and jumping up and down. Now, if you did that near to some ravenous lions in the Serengeti, I think you might find that this particular charm would work in attracting the ravenous beasts to you.
As long as you do according to the instructions, wave your arms up and down, crying, "Dumb beast, come beast."
Yes, indeed, yes. And I think the lions would come. So
I think they might come even if you didn't do that.
Well, yeah, exactly.
Actually. it's a terrific book. Again, I'm not going to pull it apart right now, but in the back, inside the back cover, is this very complicated latticework sort of covering that you have to open up. And what is in there?
Well, it's a sort of cabinet of curiosities. There's a piece of Yeti fur.
Mm-hmm.
Yetis change colour in the summer and winter, so it's the Yeti's winter coat that you can see in there.
Mm-hmm.
There's something which purports to be a bit of amber with a two-headed phoenix parasite trapped inside, a bit like sometimes millennia ago insects were trapped inside amber at the time of the dinosaurs.
Huh.
There's also a guide to the Ogham lettering with which you can communicate with some of these mythical beasts, allegedly.
Allegedly. Well, a lot of fun. Dugald Steer, the author of the Ology series, including the latest, Monsterology. Doug, thanks so much for taking time out of, you know, your worldwide travels to search for these things, to come in and speak to us.
Okay, well, thank you very much for having me here.